Side 5. All Tomorrow's Parties by William Gibson. Continued on page 167. And part of him asks himself if this is an artifact of his illness, of the 5SB, or if this vast and inward-looking eye is not, in fact, some inner aspect of that single shape comprised of every bit of data in the world. This last, he feels, is at least partly confirmed by his repeated experience of the eye everting, turning itself inside out in Möbius spasm, at which point he finds himself invariably staring at that indescribable shape. But now, when he is the eye, he is starting to be aware of someone else watching. Someone else is very interested in those images of Harwood. He feels them register each one. How can that be? The vintage plastic gunsmith cat's alarm watch pulls him from the floor. He finds it in the dark and turns off the alarm. He wonders where it came from. The old man? It is time to phone Rydell in San Francisco. He moves his fingers delicately over the disposables on the cardboard shelf, feeling for the used one with 10 minutes left. 40. Yellow ribbon. Wei Toei could make herself very small. 6 inches tall, she sat on Rydell's pillow, in the salt-frosted plastic dome of his room at the bed and breakfast, and he felt like a child. When she was small, the projection seemed more concentrated. She was brighter, and it made him think of fairies in old anime, those Disney things. She could as easily have had wings, he thought, and fly around trailing glowing dust if she wanted. But she only sat there, even more perfect at 6 inches tall, and talked with him. And when he'd close his eyes, not intending to sleep but only to rest them, he could hear that her voice was actually coming from the projector at the foot of his bed. She was telling him about Rez, the singer she'd wanted to marry, and why that hadn't worked. But it was difficult to follow. Rez had been very interested in Rez, Rydell gathered, and not much else. And Wei Toei had become more interested in other people. Or, he guessed, if you were her, in other things. But he kept slipping out of focus, falling asleep, really, and her voice was so beautiful. Before he'd stretched out here, and she'd shown him how she could get small, he'd pulled the chicken wire gate into place and spread the curtains that were thumbtacked to it, some kind of faded, nubby fabric printed with a pattern of ornate keys and strange, long-necked cats, he thought they were. He didn't know how long the sunglasses had been ringing, and it took him several rings to locate his jacket in the dark. He was fully dressed, shoes and all, otherwise, and he knew he'd been deep asleep. Hello? He put the glasses on with his left hand. With his right, he reached up and touched the ceiling. Its paneling gave slightly when he did that, so he didn't do it again.
Where are you?
It was Laney.
Bed and breakfast,
Rydell told him. With the sunglasses on, it was totally dark. He watched the low spark of his own optic nerve, colors without names.
Did you get the cables?
Yeah, Rydell said. He remembered being harsh with the sumo kid and felt stupid. He'd lost it. That claustro thing he got in crowds sometimes. Terame Allenby had told him that was called agoraphobia. And it meant fear of the mall. But it wasn't actually mall that did it to him. But he couldn't stand those little underlip beards either.
Two of them.
Use them yet?
Just the power, Rydell said. The other one, I don't know what it jacks with.
Neither do I, said Laney. Is she there?
She was, Rydell said, looking around in the dark for his fairy star, then remembering he was wearing sunglasses. His hand found a switch that dangled from a wire near his head. He clicked it. A bare 50-watt bulb came on. He slid the glasses down his nose and peered over them, finding the projector still there and still plugged in.
The thermos thing's still here.
Don't let that out of your sight, Laney said. Or the cables.
I don't know what we need her to do there, but it's all around her.
What's all around her?
The change. Lainey, she said you told her the world was going to end.
Is going to end, Lainey corrected.
Why'd you tell her that?
Lainey sighed, the deep end of his sigh becoming a cough, which he seemed to choke off.
As we know it, okay, he managed. As we know it. And that's all I or anyone else can tell you about that.
It's not what I want you thinking about. You're working for me, remember?
And you're crazy, Rydell thought, but I've got your credit chip in my pocket.
Okay, he said. What's next?
You have to go to the site of a double homicide, one that took place last night on the bridge.
What do you want me to try to find out?
Nothing, Lainey said. Just look like you're trying to find something out. Pretend. Like you're investigating. Call me when you're ready to go. I'll give you the GPS fix for the spot.
Hey, Rydell said, what if I do find something out?
Then call me.
Don't hang up, Rydell said.
How come you haven't been in touch with her, Lainey? She said you two were separated.
The people who, well, own her. That's not quite the term, really. But they'd like to talk to me, because she's missing. And the low-res people, too. So I need to be incommunicado at the moment, as far as they're concerned.
But she hasn't tried to reach me, Rydell. She'll be able to when she needs to.
He hung up. Took the glasses off, left them folded on the pillow, then crawled to the end of the bed.
Hey,
he said to the thermos thing. You there? Nothing. He started getting himself together. He unpacked his duffel,
used the switchblade to cut a couple of slits in it, took off his nylon belt and threaded it through the slits, using it as a strap, so he could sling the bag over his shoulder.
Hey, he said again to the thermos thing. You there? I'm going to unplug you now. He hesitated. Did. He put it in the duffel, along with the power cable, the other cable, and his lucky dragon fanny pack. This last because the thing had already saved his ass once, and it might be lucky. He put his nylon jacket on, put the sunglasses in his pocket, and as an afterthought, gingerly put the switchblade in his right front trouser pocket. Then he imagined it opening there, thought about its lack of a safety catch, and even more gingerly, fished it out and put it in the side pocket of his jacket. And found the place without too much trouble, though Lainey's mode of GPS by phone was pretty basic. Lainey had a fix on the spot, Rydell had no idea how, but no map of the bridge, so he triangulated Rydell's sunglasses somehow and told him to walk back toward San Francisco, lower level. Keep walking, getting warmer. Okay, turn right. Which had left Rydell facing a blank plywood partition plastered with rain-stained handbills, in a European language he didn't recognize, for a concert by someone named Ottoman Badchair. He described this to Lainey.
That isn't it, Lainey said, but you're really close.
There was a shop next door closed, and he couldn't figure out what it sold when it was open. And then a gap. Rolls of plastic back in there. Lumber. Someone was building another shop, he thought. If this was it, the crime scene, there ought to be a yellow plastic ribbon with SFPD stapled up. But then he remembered that the police didn't come out here all that much, and he wondered what they did when they had a body to dispose of. Flipping them over the side wouldn't make the city too happy, although, of course, there was no way the city could prove a particular corpse had come off the bridge. Still, it bothered Rydell that there wasn't any yellow ribbon.
He guessed he thought of it as a mark of respect. He moved in, edging past the rolls of plastic, climbing over a low stack of plywood, and spotted, in the harsh light slung from the scavenged fluorescence closer to the pedestrian stroll, two frosty-looking white marks, something aerosoled over two darker stains, and he knew what that was. Kills, the stuff you sprayed where bodily fluids had gotten out in case the person who'd lost them was seropositive. He knew what kills looked like over blood, And this was that. Not much of a crime scene. He stood there staring down at it and wondering how Laney expected him to look like he was conducting an investigation. He put the duffel with Ray Toye's projector down on the rolls of plastic. Kill's residue was fairly waterproof, so the rain hadn't washed it away. But then he knew that the victims, whoever they had been, had died the night before. He felt like an idiot. He really had wanted to be a cop once, and he'd dreamed of crossing the yellow line and looking at the scene, and being able to do something. And now here he was. He took out the glasses and called Laney. But now Laney, in whatever fine hotel he might be in Tokyo, wouldn't answer. No shit, Sherlock, Rydell said to himself, listening to a phone ring in Tokyo. 41. Trans Am. His name is Rydell, Harwood says. Image matching gave us that immediately. He was briefly associated with Cops in Trouble. Associated with whom? The knife, with its sheath and harness, was secured in a twilight alcove off the central elevator stack, approximately 800 feet below. Cops in Trouble, Harwood says. A cultural treasure. Don't you watch television? No. He is looking east, from the 48th and ultimate floor of the city's tallest building, toward the shadow of the ruined Embarcadero, the gypsy glow of the bridge, the feral darkness of Treasure Island. Stepping closer to the window, he touches his belt. Stitched between two layers of black calf is concealed a ribbon of a very particular, very expensive material. Under certain circumstances, it ceases to behave as though it were some loosely woven, tissue-thin fabric, something a child might accidentally pull to pieces, and becomes instead 30 inches of something limber, double-edged, and very sharp. Its texture in that state, its sleek translucency, has reminded him of fresh cuttle bone. You do have a sense of humor, Harwood says behind him. I know it. Leaning closer to the window, looking down, foreshortened perspective, up the side of this obelisk, this pyramid so-called, and midway, the dark bulge of that Japanese material, placed to counter old quake damage. This is new, replacing earlier splines of polycarbon, and the subject of architectural and aesthetic scandal. Briefly fascinated, he watches as reflections of the lights of surrounding buildings shudder slightly, the thing's glossy surface tensing in response to winds he cannot feel. The truss is alive. Turning to face Harwood, who is seated behind a broad dark plane of non-reflective wood, across which an accumulation of architectural models and hillocks of documents suggest the courses of imaginary rivers. A topography in which might be read change in the world beyond the window, if meanings were known, and one were sufficiently concerned, with outcomes. Harwood's eyes are the most present thing about him, the rest giving an impression of existing at one remove in some other and unspecific dimension. A tall man, he seems to occupy relatively little space, communicating from elsewhere via deliberately constricted channels. He is slender, with that agelessness of the aging rich, his long face free of tension. His eyes, enlarged by archaic lenses, are seldom still. Why do you pretend to not be interested in this former policeman visiting the site of your recent activities? On his wrist, gold and titanium catches the light, some multitasking bauble with intricate displays. I don't pretend. On the large flat screen that stands to the left of the desk, four cameras present angles on a tall, sturdy-looking man who stands, chin down, as if brooding. The cameras would be no larger than roaches, but the four images, in spite of inadequate light, offer excellent resolution. Who placed these cameras? My bright young things. Why? Against exactly this eventuality, that someone might visit the site of these two utterly forgettable deaths and stand there thinking. Look at him. He's thinking. He looks unhappy. He's trying to imagine you. You imagine he is. The fact that he's found his way to that spot at all is indicative of knowledge and motive. He knows the two men died there. Amid the various models on Harwood's desk stands one in glossy red and white, rendered with functioning miniature video screens on the trademark pylon. Tiny images move and change there in liquid crystal. Do you own the company that built this thing? Indicating the model with his index finger. The eyes behind Harwood's glasses register surprise from their peculiar distance, then interest. No, we advise them. We are a public relations firm. We did, I believe, advise on impact. We advised the city as well. It's horrible. Yes, said Harwood. Aesthetically, I agree. And that was an expressed concern of the municipal authorities. But our studies indicated that positioning it there would encourage walk-on tourism, and that is a crucial aspect of normalization. Normalization? There is an ongoing initiative to bring the bridge community back into the fold, as it were. But the issue is sensitive. A matter of image, really, and that, of course, is where we come in. Harwood smiles. A number of major cities have these autonomous zones, and how a given city chooses to deal with the situation can impact drastically on that city's image. Copenhagen, for instance, was one of the first, and has done very well. Atlanta, I suppose, would be the classic example of what not to do. Harwood blinks. It's what we do now instead of Bohemia's, he says. Instead of what? Bohemias. Alternative subcultures. They were a crucial aspect of industrial civilization in the two previous centuries. They were where industrial civilization went to dream, a sort of unconscious R&D, exploring alternate societal strategies. Each one would have a dress code, characteristic forms of artistic expression, a substance or substances of choice, and a set of sexual values at odds with those of the culture at large. And they did frequently have locales with which they became associated. But they became extinct. Extinct? We started picking them before they could ripen. A certain crucial growing period was lost as marketing evolved and the mechanisms of re-commodification became quicker, more rapacious. Authentic subcultures required backwaters and time, and there are no more backwaters. They went the way of geography in general. Autonomous zones do offer a certain insulation from the monoculture, but they seem not to lend themselves to re-commodification, not in the same way. We don't know why exactly. The little images shift, flickering. They shouldn't have put it there. Harwood's eyes come in from their private distance. I don't believe I've ever heard you express so specific an opinion. No reply. You'll have a second chance to see it. I want you to find out what our pensive friend here is thinking about. Is this concerned with what you implied when we spoke earlier? That something is on the verge of happening? Yes. And what would that be? Harwood considers him from the distance behind his glasses. Do you believe in forces of history? I believe in what brings us to the moment. I seem to have come to believe in the moment myself. I believe we are approaching one. Drawn to it by the gravity of its strangeness. It is a moment in which everything and nothing will change. I am seeking an outcome in which I will retain viability. I am seeking an outcome in which Harwood Levine will not have become four meaningless syllables. If the world is to be reborn, I wish to be reborn in it as something akin to what I am today. Thinking of the possible number and variety of crosshairs that must be trained on him now, hidden telepresent weapons platforms, he is fairly certain nonetheless that he could kill Harwood if the moment required, though he also knows that he would almost certainly predecease him, if only by some fraction of a second. I think you have become more complicated since we last met. Complex, Harwood says, and smiles. 42. Red Ghosts of European Time. Fontaine makes himself a cup of instant miso on the hot plate. This is what he drinks before bed, a soothing saltiness and bits of seaweed at the bottom. Thinking of Skinner's girl and seeing her again, usually when people leave the bridge, they don't come back. Weirdness around her departure, but he forgets what exactly. Not good for the old man, but his time nearly done then anyway. Tick, tick of the silent boy under the iPhones hunting watches. Fontaine pours his miso into a cup, missing its handle, savoring the aromatic steam. Tired now. He wonders where the boy can sleep here, or if indeed he will. Maybe sit up all night hunting watches. Fontaine shakes his head. The ticking stops. Carrying his soup, he turns to see what's arrested the ceaseless hunt. There on the screen of the notebook in the boy's lap is a scan of a battered Rolex Victory, an inexpensive wartime model for the Canadian market. Worth a fair bit now, but not in this condition. The steel case looks rough, and the dial has faded unevenly. Black Arabics from 1 to 12 are crisp, but the inner chapter, red, European time, is almost gone. Fontaine sips his miso, looking down, wondering what it is this boy sees to hold him in the red ghosts of European time. Then the boy's head sags under the weight of the iPhones, and Fontaine hears him start to snore. 43. Libya and Paco. Laney finds himself on an island in that mind-wide flow he ceaselessly cruises. It is not a construct, this place, an environment proper, so much as a knotting, a folding in of information rooted in the substrates of the oldest codes. It is something like a makeshift raft, random pieces thrown together, but it is anchored. Unmoving, he knows that it is no accident, that it has been put in his path for a reason. The reason, he soon finds, is that Libya and Paco wish to speak with him. They are associates of the Rooster, junior denizens of the walled city, and present here as a sphere of mercury in zero gravity and a black three-legged cat, respectively. The sphere of mercury, Libya, has a lovely voice. The girls, and the three-legged cat, who is also missing one eye and one ear, Paco, has a cunningly modulated growl. Laney thinks he remembers from a Mexican cartoon. They are almost certainly from Mexico City, these two, if geography needs to be taken into consideration, and very likely belong to that faction of flaming youth currently opting for the reflooding of the federal district's drained lakes. A radical urban reconfiguration that for some reason had obsessed Rei Toei in her final month in Tokyo. She had developed a fascination with large human settlements in general, and Laney had been her guide through certain of the stranger info prospects presented by what passes, this century, for town planning. So he hangs here, at the juncture of these old code routes, in a place devoid of very specific shape or texture, aside from Libya and Paco, and hears them.
The Rooster tells us you feel someone is watching you watch Cody Harwood,
says the sphere of mercury, pulsing as it speaks, its surface reflecting vehicles passing in some busy street. It might be an artifact, Laney counters, not sure he should have brought it up with the Rooster, whose paranoia is legendary. Something the 5SB generates.
We think not, says the cat.
its one-eyed filthy head propped atop an arrested drift of data. It yawns, revealing grayish-white gums, the color of boiled pork, and a single orange canine. Its one eye is yellow and hate-filled, unblinking.
We have determined that you are, in fact, being observed in your observation.
But not at the moment,
says Libya.
Because we have constructed this blind, says the cat.
Do you know who it is? Lainey asks.
It is Harwood,
says Libya, the sphere quivering delicately. Harwood? Harwood is watching me watch him?
Harwood, says the cat, dosed himself with 5SP. 3 years after you were released from the orphanage in Gainesville.
Lainey is suddenly and terribly aware of his physical being, the condition of his body. His lungs failing in a cardboard carton in the concrete bowels of Shinjuku Station. Harwood. It is Harwood whom he has sometimes imagined as the presence of God. Harwood, who is like him. Harwood who sees, Lainey now sees, the nodal points, who sees the shapes from which history emerges, and that is why he is at the very heart of the emergent cusp, this newness Lainey cannot quite glimpse. Of course Harwood is there, because Harwood, in a sense, is causing it. How do you know? He hears himself ask. And wills himself beyond the failing strictures of his body. Can you be sure?
We found a way in,
Libya chimes, the sphere distorting like a topographic learning aid, turning reflections of moving traffic into animated Escher fragments that fly together, mirroring one another.
The rooster set us to it, and we did.
And does he know? Lainey asks. Does Harwood know?
We don't think he's noticed,
growls the cat, purple-brown scabs caked on the absence of its ear.
Watch this,
says Libya, making no effort to conceal her pride. The intricately lobed surface of the mirrored shape flows and ripples, and Lainey is looking into the gray eyes of a young and very serious-looking man.
You want us to kill him, the young man says, or do I misunderstand you?
You understand me, says Harwood, his voice familiar, unmistakable, though he sounds tired.
You know, I think it's a very good idea, says the young man, but it could be done with greater surety if you gave us time for preparation. I prefer to choose the time and the terrain if possible.
Not possible, Harwood says. Do it when you can.
You don't have to give me a reason, of course, the young man says, but you must realize I'm curious. We've suggested his removal since you contracted with us.
It's time, Harwood replies. The moment. Wind catches the young man's dark scarf. It flutters, strobing the image.
What about the other one, the rent-a-cop?
Kill him if it seems he's likely to escape. Otherwise it might be useful if he could be questioned. He's in this too, but I don't see exactly how.
Libya becomes a sphere again, rotating. Lainey closes his eyes and gropes in the close electric dark for the blue cough syrup. He feels the hate-filled yellow eye watching him, but he imagines it as Harwood's. Harwood knows. Harwood took the 5SB. Harwood is like him.
But Harwood has an agenda of his own. And it is from this agenda, in part, that the situation is emerging. Lainey cracks the seal, drinks the blue syrup. He must think now.
44. Just when you think. The rain wasn't coming back, Chivette decided, shrugging her shoulders against the weight of Skinner's jacket. She was sitting on a bench behind a stack of empty poultry crates, and she knew she should be going somewhere, but she just couldn't. Thinking about Skinner dying here, about what Fontaine had said.
the knife in the inside pocket, its handle digging into her left collarbone, the way she was slouched. She straightened her back against the plywood behind her and tried to pull herself together. She had to find Tessa and get back to the van, and she had to do that if she could without running into Carson. It was possible, she figured, that he hadn't even seen her run out, even though she was sure somehow that when she'd seen him, he'd been looking for nobody but her. But if he hadn't seen her, and he wouldn't have found her there, then probably that bar would be the last place she would expect to find him now. And if he had seen her, then he wouldn't think she'd go back there either, which would also put him somewhere else. And it was possible that Tessa, who liked her beers, would be there still, because she sure hadn't been keen on bedding down in the van. Probably Tessa thought that the bar was way interstitial, so it might just be that Chivette, if she was careful about it, could slip in there and get her back to the van. Carson wasn't too likely to come sniffing around the foot of Folsom, and if he did, he was liable to run into the kind of people who'd take him for easy meat. But it was no good sitting here, this close to chicken crates, because that was a good way to catch lice, and just the thought of it made her scalp itch. She stood up, stretched, smelling the faint ammonia tang of chicken shit, and set off through the upper level toward the city, keeping an eye out for Carson. Not many people out now, and none of them tourists. The rain could do that, she remembered. Once again she got that feeling that she loved this place, but wasn't really a part of it anymore. Kind of twisted in like a hook. Not a big feeling, but sharp and deep. She sighed, remembering foggy mornings when she'd come down from the cable tower with her bike over her shoulder and pumped it over to Allied, wondering if Bunny'd have a scratch for a ride off, a good ticket to pull, or if he'd give her a deadhead, what they called a pickup outside the city core. She'd liked a deadhead sometimes, because she got to see parts of town she might not have ridden before. And sometimes she'd wind up clean, what they called it when you didn't have any deliveries. And that could be great, too. Just go over to Alcoholicost, or one of the other messenger bars, and drink espresso until Bunny paged her. It had been pretty good riding for Allied. She'd never even eaten it, wiped out bad. And the cops weren't as book-happy if you were a girl. You could get away with doing sidewalks and stuff. Not that she could imagine going back to it now, riding. And that brought her mood back, because she didn't know what else she could do. Whatever. She wasn't going to star in any new versions of Tessa's docu. She remembered this skinny tech named Tara May, somebody cops in trouble had sent over to grab footage of poor Rydell, who'd only ever wanted a feature in a segment of that thing. No, she corrected herself, that wasn't fair, because she knew that what Rydell had really wanted was to be a cop, which was what he'd started out to be in Tennessee. But it hadn't worked out. And then his episode hadn't worked out, let alone the miniseries they'd talked about spinning off. Mainly, she supposed, because what Tara May had shot had convinced the cops in trouble people that Rydell looked a little on the heavy side on TV. Not that there was any fat on him, he was all muscle and long legs. But when they shot him, he didn't look like that. And that had driven him sort of crazy. That and Tara May always going on about how Chivette should take speech and acting classes, learn all these martial arts, and give up drugs. When Chivette had made it clear that she didn't do drugs, Tara May had said that that would make networking a little harder, not having anything to quit, but that there were groups for everything, and that was probably the best way to meet people who could help you with your career. But Chivette hadn't wanted a career, or not the way Tara May meant it, and Tara May just hadn't been able to get that. Actually, there were a lot of people like Tara May in Hollywood. Maybe even most people were. Everybody had something they really did. Drivers wrote. Bartenders acted. She'd had massages from a girl who was really a stunt double for some actress Chivette had never heard of yet, except she hadn't really ever been called. But they had her number. Somebody had everybody's number. But it looked to Chivette like the game had all their numbers, every one, and nobody really was winning. But nobody wanted to hear that, or talk to you much if you didn't buy into what they really did. Now she thought about it, that was part of what had gotten between her and Rydell. because he'd always buy into that, whatever anybody told him they really were. And then he'd tell them how he really wanted to do an episode of Cops in Trouble, and how it looked like he actually would, because Cops in Trouble was paying his rent now, which nobody wanted to hear, really, because it was a little too real. But Rydell never got that. And then they'd hit on him for phone numbers, names, intros, and start slipping him discs and lists of credits, hoping he was dumb enough to go back and try to show them to producers. Which he was. Or, anyway, good-hearted enough. And that hadn't helped him any with the people at Cops in Trouble, either. And that, somehow, was how she'd wound up with Carson. Rydell sitting on the couch in that apartment with the lights off, watching one old Cops in Trouble after another, looking lost. And she just hadn't been able to handle it. It had been fine when they'd had things to do together. But when it came to just being together, that hadn't seemed to work. And Rydell going into that sad thing when it had started to look like it wasn't going to work out with the show. But here was the bar, a small crowd around the door now, and the sound of music she'd been hearing but not really listening to, which died as she got up close to the crowd. The place was packed. She slid in sideways between a couple of Mexicans, looked like truck drivers, had those steel, chisel-toe things tacked to the front of their black cowboy boots. Inside, over the heads of the people packed on the floor, she could see Creedmoor, with a microphone in his hand, grinning out over the crowd. It was a dancer grin, 10,000 watts of bad electricity, and she saw he had the start of that thing the dancer did to your gums. People were clapping and whistling for more, and Creedmoor, his face running with sweat, looked like he was intending to give it to them.
Thank you kindly, she heard Creedmoor's amplified voice say. Now this next number's one I wrote myself, and it's going out soon as our first single, Buell Creedmoor and His Lower Companions, and it's called Just When You Think You Got It Dicked.
Or anyway, that was what she thought she heard him say. But then the band kicked in loud, with the guitarist choking steely serpentine chords out of a big, shiny old red electric, and she couldn't make out any of the words, although she had to admit it sounded like Creedmoor could sing. They were jammed in here so tight it made it hard to keep a lookout for Carson, but on the other hand, it wasn't too likely he'd be able to see her either. She kept moving, as best she could, trying to find Tessa. 45. Jack Move. Rydell had taken a surveillance course back at the academy, and his favorite part had been going out and following people. It wasn't something you did alone, but with at least one partner, and the more partners the better. You learned how to trade off, somebody taking your place, and how to deke up ahead of the subject so you'd be ready when the next guy needed to trade off. That way the subject never had the same person behind him for too long. There was a definite art to it, and when you got it down, it was sort of like a dance. He hadn't really gotten the chance to put it into practice in his very brief career as a police officer, or later when he'd worked for Intensicure, but he felt like he'd been pretty good at it, and it had given him an idea of what it would feel like if you were being followed, and particularly if you were being followed by some people who knew how to do it right. And that was what he found himself thinking about now, as he shouldered the duffel with Ray Toei's projector in it and prepared to depart this pathetic excuse for a crime scene. If Lainey had wanted him to attract someone's attention by standing here, well, he'd stood here. But maybe now, he thought, he was getting that watched feeling because Lainey had told him he'd be sure to be noticed if he came here. Could be nerves. Maybe. But actually, he didn't feel nervous, just tired. He'd driven all night up the coast with Creedmoor, and all the downtime he'd had today had been when he'd fallen asleep listening to Ray Toei. What he felt like now was going back to his room, checking out the projector to see if she'd come back, then hitting the bed. But there it was, that prickling at the back of his neck. He turned and looked back, but there was nobody, just the place where the kills had been sprayed over dried blood. Guy going by in the direction of Oakland and Rydell's room. Young guy with dark military buzzed hair, black coat, black scarf up around his face. Seemed not to see Rydell, just kept walking, hands in his pockets. Rydell fell in behind him about 15 feet. He tried to imagine this place the way it had been before, when it was a regular bridge. Millions of cars had gone through here, this same space where he walked now. It had all been open then, just girders and railing and deck. Now it was this tunnel, everything patched together out of junk, used lumber, plastic, whatever people could find. All of it lashed up, however anybody could get it to stay, it looked like. And somehow it did stay, in spite of the winds he knew must come through here. He'd been back in a bayou once in Louisiana, and something about the way it looked in here reminded him of that. There was stuff hanging everywhere, tubing and cables, and things whose function he couldn't identify. And it was like Spanish moss in a way. Everything softened at the outline. And the light now was dim and sort of underwater-looking. Just these banks of scavenged fluorescence slung every 20 feet or so, some of them dead and others flickering. He walked around a puddle where a vendor had dumped about 10 pounds of dirty shaved ice. Up ahead, he saw the guy with the black scarf turn into a cafe, one of these tiny little places you got in here, maybe 2 small tables and a counter that sat 4 or 5. Big blonde boy, looked like a weightlifter, was coming out as the scarf went in. And the weightlifter made just that little bit of eye contact with Rydell that told him. They were doing him. The trade-off. He was being tailed, and by at least 3 people. Weightlifter started in the direction of Rydell's bed and breakfast, Treasure Island, Oakland. Back of his neck as wide as Rydell's thigh. As Rydell passed the cafe, he looked in and saw the scarf ordering a coffee, just as normal as pie. So he didn't look behind him, because he knew that if he did that, they'd know. They would. Just like he'd known when the weightlifter blew it by looking him in the eye. The belt he'd slung the duffel from was cutting into his shoulder through his nylon jacket. And he thought about Lainey and Klaus and the rooster, about how they all obviously thought the projector was really important or valuable. Was that what he was being followed for? Or was it about this mystery man of Lainey's, his man who wasn't there? Otherwise, he didn't think he had any serious long-term enemies up here, though it was hard to be sure. And he didn't think these guys were ordinary jackers, because it looked to him like they really knew what they were doing. He reached into the jacket pocket and felt the knife. It was there, and he was glad he had it, though the thought of actually cutting somebody with it bothered him. The thing about knives was that the people who thought they wanted to use them on other people usually had no idea how much mess it made. It wasn't like in the movies. Cut people bled like stuck pigs. He'd had to deal with a few cut people around the Sunset Lucky Dragon, and it could get tricky, because who knew who was seropositive? He and Durius had these goggles they were supposed to put on to keep people's blood from getting in their eyes, but usually it just happened all at once, and they didn't remember the goggles until it was likely too late anyway. But the main thing about knives, even ones that cut steel belt radials like ripe banana, was that they weren't much good in a gunfight. Someone had slung up an old anti-shoplifting mirror above a closed stall, and as he approached this, he tried to see who might be following him, but there was enough foot traffic in here that he only got a generalized sense of people moving. But what really bothered him now was that he was just doing what they'd probably expect him to, heading back to wherever he was going to spend the night, assuming they didn't already know where that was. And once he got there, what then? He'd be trapped up in his room, no exit but that ladder, and they'd have him. He guessed he could just keep walking, but he didn't see what that would get him either. What he needed, he thought, was something he could do that they weren't expecting, something that put the shoe on the other foot. Or anyway, he should lose them, whoever they were. Then maybe he could raise Lainey and get Lainey's take on who they might be. He'd had an instructor in Knoxville who'd like to talk about lateral thinking, which in a way wasn't that far off what Durius meant when he talked about serious users getting lateral out on the sidewalk outside Lucky Dragon. Just losing it. What it took sometimes was just your basic jack move, something nobody, maybe even you, was expecting. To his right now, he saw he was passing a stretch of wall that was actually canvas, like a sail or an old tent, stretched tight over lumber, and maybe half an inch thick with however many coats of paint it had had since it was put up here. Some kind of mural. But he wasn't noticing that. The switchblade sounded so loud opening it that he was sure they'd have heard it. So he just moved, sweeping the ceramic blade down, then sideways, to cut himself a backward L, through which he ducked and stepped, as if in a dream, the paint on the canvas crackling as he did so, into warmth and a different light, and these completely unexpected people seated around a table, cards in their hands, mother-of-pearl chips piled on the table in front of them, and one of them, a woman, the nipples of her bare breasts transfixed with surgical steel, the stub of a small cigar wedged into the corner of her mouth, met Rydell's eye and said, "I'll see you one and raise you one." "Never mind me," Rydell heard himself say, as he saw a man with a tattooed scalp, still holding his hand of cards, raise his other hand, with a gun in it, from beneath the table. And simultaneously he realized that he still had the black knife open in his hand. He felt a weird wash of cold down his spine as his feet just kept moving, past the table, and the man, and the deep and somehow limitlessly large black hole in the winking ring of stainless steel that was the pistol's muzzle. Through a thick brown velour curtain that smelled of ancient movie houses, and he was still moving, apparently intact. Feeling his hand thumb the button, closing and cocking the blade against his hip as he went, something he wouldn't have thought of doing otherwise, pocketing the knife. In front of him a ladder, rough sawn from 2x4s, straight to it and just climbing as fast as he could. Took him up through a square hole in a splintered timber deck, narrow walkway between walls cut from peeling billboards. A woman's huge, stained paper eye faded there, as if staring into infinite distance. Stop. Breathe. Heart pounding. Listen. Laughter. The card players? He started along the walkway, feeling a rising sense of triumph. He'd done it. Lost them. Wherever he was up here, he'd be able to find his way back out and down, and then he'd see how it went. But he had the projector, and he'd lost them, and he hadn't gotten his ass shot for interrupting somebody's poker game. Lateral thinking, he said, congratulating himself as he reached the end of the walkway and rounded a corner. He felt the rib crack as the weightlifter hit him and knew that the black glove, like the ones he'd trained with in Nashville, was weighted with lead. It sent him back against the opposite wall, his head slamming against that, and his whole left side refused to move when he tried. The weightlifter pulled the black glove back for a roundhouse into Rydell's face and smiled. Rydell tried to shake his head. Faintest look of surprise, maybe confusion, in the other's eyes, his face. Then nothing. The smile gone slack. The weightlifter went suddenly and very heavily to his knees, swayed, and crashed sideways to the gray timber deck, revealing behind him this slender, gray-haired man in a long, smooth coat the color of old moss, who was replacing something there, the lapel held open with his other hand. Eyes regarding Rydell through gold-rimmed glasses. A deep crease up each cheek, like he smiled a lot. The man adjusted his beautiful coat and lowered his hands. "Are you injured?" Rydell drew a ragged breath, wincing as the rib seemed to grate.
"Rib,"
he managed. "Are you armed?" Rydell looked into the clear, bright, unmoving eyes.
"Knife in my right pocket," he said.
"Please keep it there," the man said. "Are you able to walk?"
"Sure,"
Rydell said, taking a step and almost falling on the weightlifter. "Come with me, please," the man said and turned, and Rydell followed. 46. Pine Box. Creedmoor was into the climax of his number before Chevette spotted God's little toy cruising past overhead. The bar, like a lot of spaces here on the original deck, didn't have a ceiling of its own, just the bottom of whatever floor areas had been erected above it, with the result that what passed for a ceiling was uneven and irregular. The management had at some point sprayed all that black, and Chevette might not have noticed the floating camera platform, if its Mylar balloon hadn't caught and reflected the stage lights. It was definitely under human control, and looked like it might be jockeying to get a close-up of Creedmoor. Then Chevette spotted two more of the silver balloons, these parked up in a sort of hollow created by discontinuity in the floors above. That meant, she thought, that Tessa had gotten someone to drive her back to the foot of Folsom. Then, either she'd driven back or gotten a lift. She was pretty sure Tessa wouldn't have walked it, not with the balloons anyway. Chevette hoped the latter because she didn't want to have to try to find a space to park the van a second time. Whatever Tessa was up to here, they were going to need a place to sleep, later. Creedmoor's song ended with a sort of yodeling cry of brainless defiance, which was echoed back, amplified into a terrifying roar, by the mesh-back crowd. Chevette was amazed by the enthusiasm, not so much that it was for Creedmoor, as it was for this kind of music. Music was strange that way, though. There were people into any damn thing, it seemed like, and if you got enough of them together in one bar, she guessed, you could have a pretty good time. She was still working her way through the crowd, warding off the odd grope, looking for Tessa, and keeping an eye out for Carson, when Creedmoor's friend Mary Alice found her. Mary Alice had undone a couple of extra increments of bustier, it looked like, and was presenting as very ample indeed. She looked really happy, or anyway as happy as you can look when you're really drunk, which she definitely and obviously was. "Honey!" she cried, grabbing Chevette by the shoulders. "Where have you been? We got all kinds of free drinks for our industry guests." Mary Alice clearly didn't remember Chevette having told her that she and Tessa weren't A&R people, but Chevette guessed that there was quite a lot, usually, that Mary Alice didn't remember. "That's great," Chevette said. "Have you seen Tessa, my friend, I was here with? She's Australian." "Up in the light booth with St. Vitus, honey. She's getting Buell's whole performance on those little balloon things." Mary Alice beamed, gave Chevette a big lipstick-greasy kiss on the cheek, and instantly forgot her, face going blank as she turned in what Chevette supposed would be the direction of the bar. But the light booth now, she could see that, a sort of oversized matte black crate tacked up against the angle of the wall opposite the stage, with a warped plastic window running its length, through which she could see quite plainly the faces of Tessa and some bald-headed boy with mean-looking, slitty black glasses, just their two heads in there, like puppet heads, reached, she saw, by an aluminum stepladder fastened to the wall with lengths of rusting pipe strap. Tessa had her own special glasses on, and Chevette knew she'd be seeing the output from God's little toy, adjusting angle and focus with her black glove. Creedmoor had launched into another song, its tempo faster, and people were tapping their feet and bobbing up and down in time. A couple of men in those mesh-back caps drinking beer out of cans by that ladder, but she ducked under their arms and climbed up, ignoring the one who laughed and swatted her butt with the flat of his hand. Up through the square hole, her nose level with dusty, beer-soaked brown carpet. "Tessa? Hey.
Chevette?"
Tessa didn't turn, lost in the view of her glasses.
"Where'd you go?"
"I saw Carson," Chevette said, climbing up through the hole. "I took off."
"This is amazing footage," Tessa said. "The faces on these people, like Robert Frank. I'm going to treat it as a mono and grain it down."
"Tessa," Chevette said, "I think we should get out of here."
"Who the fuck are you?" said the baldy, turning. He was wearing a sleeveless tube shirt, and his upper arms were no thicker than Chevette's wrists, his bare shoulders looking fragile as the bones of a bird.
"This is St. Vitus,"
Tessa said, as if absently bidding to forestall hostilities, attention elsewhere.
"He does the lights in here, but he's the sound man at two other clubs on the bridge, Cognitive Dissidence and something else,"
Tessa's hand dancing with itself in the black control glove. Chevette knew Cogdis from before. "That's a dancer bar, Tessa," she said.
"We're going over there after this," Tessa said. "He says it'll be just getting going, and it'll be a lot more interesting than this."
"Anything would," St. Vitus said with infinite weariness.
Blue Ahmed cut a single there, Tessa said, called My War is My War.
It's sucked, Chevette said. You're thinking of the Chrome Koran cover, said St. Vitus, his voice dripping with contempt. You've never heard Ahmed's version.
How the fuck would you know? Chevette demanded. Because it was never released, St. Vitus declared smugly.
Well, maybe it fucking escaped, Chevette said, feeling like she wanted to deck this diz monkey and thinking it might not be that hard to do, although you never knew what would happen if somebody tightened on Dancer got really upset. All those stories about 12-year-olds getting so dizzed they'd grab the bumper of a cop car and flip the whole thing, though these usually involved the kids' muscles popping out through their skins, which she sincerely hoped was impossible. Had to be. What Carson called urban legends. Creedmoor's song ended with a steely clash of guitar that drew Chevette's attention to the stage. Creedmoor looked completely tightened now, staring triumphantly out as though across a sea of faces in some vast stadium. The big guitarist unslung his red guitar and handed it to a boy with sideburns and a black leather vest, who passed him a black guitar with a skinnier body.
"This here's called Pine Box," Creedmoor said, as the big guitarist began to play.
Chevette couldn't catch the words as Creedmoor began to sing, except that it sounded old and doleful, and was about winding up in a pine box, by which she took him to mean a coffin, like what they used to bury people in. But she guessed it could just as easily apply to this sound booth she was stuck in here with Tessa and this asshole. She looked around and saw an old chrome stool with its pad of upholstery split and taped over, so she planted herself on that and decided she was just going to keep quiet until Tessa had taped as much as she wanted of Creedmoor's act. Then she'd see about getting them out of here.
47. Saixing Road. Libya and Paco have shown Lainey to a barber shop in Saixing Road. He has arrived here, of course, with no knowledge of the route involved. Saixing is in the walled city, and he is a visitor, not a resident. The walled city's whereabouts, the conceptual mechanisms by which its citizens have opted to secede from the human datascape at large, are the place's central and most closely held secret. The walled city is a universe unto itself, a subversive rumor, the stuff of legend. Lainey has been here before, although not to this specific construct, this barber shop, and he dislikes the place. Something in the underlying code of the walled city's creation induces a metaphysical vertigo, and the visual representation is tediously aggressive, as though one were caught in some art school video production with infinitely high production values. Nothing is ever straightforward in the walled city. Nothing is ever presented as written, but filtered instead through half a dozen species of carefully cultivated bit rot, as though the inhabitants were determined to express their massive attitude right down into the least fractal texture of the place. Where a clever website might hint at dirt, at wear, the walled city luxuriates in apparent frank decay, in texture maps that constantly unravel, revealing of other textures equally moth-eaten. This barbershop, for instance, is shingled from overlapping tiles of texture, so that they don't quite match up at their edges, deliberately spoiling any illusion of surface or place. And everything here is done in a palette of rain-wet Chinatown neon, pink, blue, yellow, pale green, and the authoritatively faded red. Libya and Paco depart immediately, leaving Lainey to wonder how he, were he to bother, might choose to present himself in this environment, perhaps as a large cardboard carton? Klaus and the rooster put an end to this surmise, however, abruptly appearing in two of the shop's four barber chairs. They look as he remembers them, except that Klaus now wears a black leather version of his snap-brim fedora, its brim turned up all around, and the rooster somehow looks even more like one of Francis Bacon's screaming popes.
"Whole new game here," Lainey opens.
"How so?"
Klaus appears to suck his teeth. Harwood's had 5SB, and you know it too, because those Chilango kids of yours just told me. How long have you known?
We operate on a need-to-know basis,
the rooster begins in full geek pontificator mode, but Klaus cuts him off. About 10 minutes longer than you have. We are anxious to know what you make of it. It changes everything, Laney says. The way he's been successful all these years, the public relations empire, advertising, the rumors that he was pivotal in getting President Milbank elected, that he was behind the partition of Italy.
I thought that was his girlfriend, the rooster says sullenly. That Padanian princess.
You mean he's only picking winners? Klaus demands. You're suggesting that he's in nodal mode and simply gets behind emerging change? If that's all it is, my friend, why aren't you one of the richest men in the world?
It doesn't work that way, Laney protests. 5SB allows the apprehension of nodal points, discontinuities in the texture of information. They indicate emerging change, but not what that change will be.
True, agrees Klaus and purses his lips.
What I want to know, Laney says, what I need to know, and right now, is what Harwood is up to. He's sitting at the cusp of some unprecedented potential for change. He appears to be instrumental in it. Ray Toe is in it, too, and this freelance people eraser of Harwood's, and an out-of-work rent-a-cop. These people are about to change human history in some entirely new way. There hasn't been a configuration like this since 1911.
What happened in 1911?
The rooster demands.
Laney sighs. I'm still not sure. It's complicated, and I haven't had the time to really look at it. Madame Curie's husband was run over by a horse-drawn wagon in Paris in 1906. It seems to start there. But if Harwood is the strange attractor here, the crucial piece of weirdness things need to accrete around, and he's self-aware in that role, what is it he's trying to do that has the potential to literally change everything?
We aren't positive, the rooster begins, but
nanotechnology, Klaus says. Harwood was a major player in Sunflower Corporation, a scheme to rebuild San Francisco. Very radical restructuring, employing nanotechnology along much the lines it was employed post-quake in Tokyo. That didn't fly, and very oddly indeed, it looks to us as though your man Rydell was somehow instrumental in helping it not to fly. But that can wait. My point is that Harwood has demonstrated an ongoing interest in nanotechnology, and this has manifested most recently in a collaboration between Nanofax AG of Geneva.
Harwood Front, the rooster says. One through a shell corporation in Antigua.
Shut up. And the rooster does. Between Nanofax AG of Geneva and the Lucky Dragon Corporation of Singapore. Lucky Dragon is a Harwood Levine client, of course.
Nanofax?
Everything the name implies, says Klaus, and considerably less.
What's that supposed to mean?
Nanofax AG offers a technology that digitally reproduces objects physically at a distance, within certain rather large limitations, of course. A child's doll placed in a Lucky Dragon Nanofax unit in London will be reproduced in the Lucky Dragon Nanofax unit in New York.
How?
With assemblers, out of whatever's available. But the system's been placed under severe legal constraints. It can't, for instance, reproduce functional hardware. And, of course, it can't, most particularly can't, reproduce functional nano-assemblers.
I thought that they'd proven that didn't work anyway, Laney says.
Oh, no, says the rooster. They just don't want it to.
They who?
Nation states,
says the rooster.
Remember them?
48. In the moment. Rydell watched this man move ahead in front of him and felt something complicated, something he couldn't get a handle on, but something that came through anyway, through the ache in his side, the pain that grated there if he stepped wrong. He'd always dreamed of a special kind of grace, Rydell, of just moving, moving right, without thinking of it, alert, relaxed, there. And somehow he knew that that was what he was seeing now, what he was following, this guy, who was maybe 50, and who moved, though without seeming to think about it, in a way that kept him in every bit of available shadow, upright in his long wool coat, hands in pockets. He just moved, and Rydell followed, in his pain and the clumsiness that induced, but also in the pain somehow of his adolescent heart, the boy in him having wanted all these years to be something like this man, whoever and whatever he was. A killer, Rydell reminded himself, thinking of the weightlifter they'd left behind. Rydell knew that killing was not the explosive handshake exchange of movies, but a terrible dark marriage unto, and perhaps, though he hoped not, even beyond the grave, as still his own dreams were sometimes visited by the shade of Kenneth Turvey, the only man he'd ever had to kill. Though he'd never doubted the need of killing Turvey, because Turvey had been demonstrating his seriousness with random shots through the door of a closet in which he'd locked his girlfriend's children. Killing anyone was a terrible and permanent thing to enter into, Rydell believed, and he also knew that violent criminals in real life were about as romantic as a lapful of guts. Yet here he was, doing the best he could to keep up with this gray-haired man who'd just killed someone in a manner Rydell would have been unable to specify, but silently and without raising a sweat, who'd just killed someone the way another man might change his shirt or open a bottle of beer. And something in Rydell yearned so to be that, that, feeling it now, he blushed. The man stopped in shadow, looking back. "How are you?" "Fine," Rydell said, which was almost always what he said if anyone asked him that. "You are not fine. You are injured. You may be bleeding internally." Rydell halted in front of him, hand pressed to his burning side. "What did you do to that guy?" You couldn't have said that the man smiled, but the creases in his cheeks seemed to deepen slightly. "I completed the movement he began when he struck you." "You stabbed him with something," Rydell said. "Yes. That was the most elegant conclusion under the circumstances. His unusual center of gravity made it possible to sever the spinal cord without contacting the vertebrae themselves." This in a tone that someone might use to describe the discovery of a new but convenient bus route. "Show me." The man's head moved, just a fraction. Some bird-like acuity. Light winked, reflected in the round, gold-framed glasses. He reached into the open front of his long coat and produced, with a very peculiar and offhand grace, a blade, curved, upswept, chisel-tipped, what they called a tanto, Rydell knew. The short version of one of those Japanese swords. The same light that had caught in the round lenses now snagged for an instant in a hair-fine line of rainbow along the curved edge and the angled tip, and then the man reversed the movement that had produced the knife. It vanished within the coat as though a segment of tape had been run backward. Rydell remembered being taught how you had to use something, anything, if someone was coming after you with a knife and you were unarmed. If nothing else, you were supposed to take off your jacket and roll it around your hands and wrists to protect them. Now he imagined using the projector in its bag as a sort of shield to ward off the knife he'd just seen, and the hopelessness of the idea actually struck him as funny. "Why did you smile?" the man asked. Rydell stopped smiling. I don't think I could explain, he said. Who are you?
I can't tell you that, the man said. I'm Barry Rydell, Rydell said. You saved my ass back there. But not your torso, I think. He might have killed me. No, the man said. He wouldn't have killed you. He would have rendered you helpless, taken you to a private location, and tortured you to extract information. Then he would have killed you. Well, Rydell said, uneasy with the matter-of-factness here. Thanks. You are welcome, said the man, with great gravity and not the least hint of irony. Well, Rydell said, why did you do that? Take him out. Because it was necessary to complete the movement. I don't get it, said Rydell. It was necessary, the man said. There are a number of these men seeking you tonight. I'm uncertain of how many. They are mercenaries. Did you kill someone else back there last night? Where those patches of dried blood and kills are? Yes, the man said. And I'm safer with you than I am with these guys you say are mercs? I think so, yes, the man said, frowning, as though he took the question very seriously. You kill anybody else in the past 48 hours? No, the man said, I did not. Well, Rydell said, I guess I'm with you. I'm sure not going to try to fight you. That is wise, the man said. And I don't think I could run fast enough, or very far, with this rib. That is true. So what do we do? Rydell shrugged, instantly regretting it, his face contorting in a grimace of pain. We will leave the bridge, the man said, and seek medical aid for your injury. I myself have a thorough working knowledge of anatomy should it prove necessary. Oh, thanks, Rydell managed. If I could just buy some 4-inch tape and some analgesic plasters at that lucky dragon, I could probably make do. He looked around, wondering when he'd next see or be seen by the one with the scarf. He had a feeling the scarf was the one he'd really have to watch out for. He couldn't say why. What if those mercs scope us leaving? Don't anticipate outcome, the man said. Await the unfolding of events. Remain in the moment. In the moment, Rydell decided he knew for a fact his ass was lost. Just plain lost. 49. Radon Shadow. Fontaine finds the boy an old camping pad, left here by his children, perhaps, and lays him back on this, still snoring. Removing the heavy iPhones, he sees how the boy sleeps with his eyes half open, showing the white. Imagines watches ticking past there, one after another. He covers him with an old sleeping bag whose faded flannel liner depicts mountains and bears, and then takes his miso back to the counter to think. There is a faint vibration now, the weather of the shop's flimsy fabric, the bones of the bridge, or the underlying plates of the earth, he cannot tell. But small sounds come from the shelves and cabinets as tiny survivors of the past register this new motion. A lead soldier, on one shelf, topples forward with a definitive clack, and Fontaine makes a mental note to buy more museum wax, a sticky substance meant to prevent this. Fontaine, seated on his high stool behind the counter, sipping gingerly at his hot miso, wonders what exactly he would see were he to follow the boy's course today via the notebook's recall function. That business with the lockboxes and Marshall getting all worked up. Where else might the boy have been? But nowhere really dangerous, Fontaine decides, if he's only chasing watches. But how was it he did that? Got those lockbox lists? Fontaine puts the miso down and fishes the Jaeger LeCoultre from his pocket. He reads the ordnance marks on its back. G6B/346, RA arrow AF, 172/53. The 6B denoting a particular grade of movement, degree of accuracy, he knows, though the 346 is a mystery. The broad arrow, central, the Queen's mark, her property. 53, the year of issue. But 172? Could the boy somehow pry knowledge from these numbers if the question could be put to him? Somewhere out there, Fontaine knows, every last bit of information makes its way into the stream. He puts the watch down on his Rolex pad and takes up the salty miso again. Looking down through the scratch-frosted glass countertop, he notices a recent purchase, not yet examined. A Helbros from the 1940s, styled after military watches, but not an issue watch. Something he bought from a scavenger down from the Oakland Hills. He reaches into the counter and brings it out. A shabby thing after the G6B. Its bezel is badly dinged, probably too badly to benefit from buffing, and the luminous on the dull black dial has gone a shade of silvery ash. He takes his loop from his other pocket and screws it into his eye, turning the Helbros under his 10-power Cyclops gaze. The case back has been removed, screwed back in, but left untightened. He turns it out with his fingers to check inside for minute graven records of its repair history. He squints through the loop. The last repair date etched into the inside back is August 1945. He turns it over again and studies it. The crystal is synthetic, some sort of plastic, definitely vintage, and very probably original. Because, he sees, holding it at just this certain angle to the light, radiation from the original radium numerals has darkened the crystal focally, each number having in effect radiographed itself in the accidental plate of the crystal. And somehow this, combined with the hidden date, gives Fontaine a shiver. So he puts the case back into place, replaces the Helbros in the counter, checks the locks on the door, finishes his miso, and starts to ready himself for bed. The boy, on his back, is no longer snoring, and that is a good thing. When Fontaine lies down on his own narrow bunk to sleep, the Smith & Wesson kit gun, as it is every night, is at the ready. 50. More trouble. Rydell's father, dying of cancer, had told Rydell a story. He claimed to have gotten it from a book of famous last words, or if not famous, then at least memorable. This man was being executed in England back in the old days when execution was made as deliberately hard a thing as possible, and after being burned with hot irons, broken on the wheel, and various other horrific punishments, the man was shown the block, the headsman's axe, and having been closed-mouthed and stolid throughout his various tortures, he had looked at the axe and the block and the burly headsman and made no reply at all. But then another torturer arrived carrying an assortment of terrible-looking tools, and the man was informed that he was to be disemboweled prior to his beheading. The man sighed. "More trouble," he said. "If they want me," Rydell said, wincing along beside the man with the Tonto in his coat, "why don't they just grab me?" "Because you are with me." "Why don't they just shoot you?" "Because we have, these men and I, the same employer, in a sense." "He wouldn't let them shoot you?" "That would depend," the man said. Rydell could see that they were coming up on a nameless bar where he'd heard Buell Creedmore sing that old song. There was noise there, loud music, laughter, a crowd around the door, drinking beer and openly smoking cigarettes. His side hurt with each step he took, and he thought of Retoé perched on his pillow, glowing. What, he wondered, did the projector slung over his shoulder mean to her? Was it her only means of manifesting here? Of interacting with people? Did being a hologram feel like anything? He doubted it. Or did the programs that generated her somehow provide some greater illusion of being there? But if you weren't real in the first place, what did you have to compare not being there to? But what really bothered him now was that Lainey and Klaus and the rooster, too, had thought that the projector was important, really important. And now here he went, Rydell, limping willingly along beside this killer, this man who evidently worked for whoever it was after Rydell's ass, and probably after the projector as well, and he was just going along with it. Sheep to the slaughter. "I want to go in here a minute," Rydell said. "Why?" "See a friend," Rydell said. "Is this a bid for escape?" "I don't want to go with you." The man regarded him from behind the thin crystal rounds of his glasses. "You are complicating things," he said. "So kill me," Rydell said, gritting his teeth as he slung his weight around and staggered past the smokers by the door into the warm, loud beer smell and crowd energy. Creedmoor was on stage with Randy Schoetz and a bass player with sideburns, and whatever they were playing reached its natural conclusion at just that point, Creedmoor jumping into the air as he let out a final whoop, and the music crashed down around him, the crowd roaring and stomping and clapping. Rydell had seen Creedmoor's eyes flash flat and bright as a doll's in the stage light. "Hey, Buell!" Rydell shouted. "Creedmoor!" He shouldered someone out of his way and kept going. He was a few feet from the stage now. "Buell!" It was just a little thing, the stage, maybe a foot high, and the crowd wasn't that thick. Creedmoor saw him. He stepped down from the stage. The singer's pearl-button cowboy shirt was open to the waist, his hollow white chest gleaming with sweat. Someone handed him a towel, and he wiped his face with it, grinning, showing long yellow teeth and no gum.
"Rydell," he said, "son of a bitch! Where you been?"
"Looking for you, Buell." The man with the knife put his hand on Rydell's shoulder. "This is unwise," he said.
"Hey, Buell," Rydell said, "get me a beer, okay?" "You see me, Rydell? I was fucking Jesus' son, man, fucking Hank Williams, motherfucker!"
Creedmoor beamed, yet Rydell saw the thing that was waiting there to toggle into rage. Someone handed Creedmoor two tall cans already opened. He passed one to Rydell. Creedmoor splashed cold malt liquor down his chest, rubbed himself with it.
"Damn, I'm good!"
"We can be too easily contained here," the man said.
"There go my buddy there," said Creedmoor, noticing the man for the first time. "Faggot,"
he added, as if further taking in the man's appearance and seeming to have difficulty placing it in any more convenient category of abuse. "Buell," Rydell said, reaching up and grabbing the man's wrist, "want you to meet a friend of mine."
"Looks like some faggot ought to be killed with a shovel,"
Creedmoor observed, slit-eyed and furious now, the toggle having been thrown.
"Let go of my shoulder," Rydell said to the man quietly. "It doesn't look good."
The man let go of Rydell's shoulder.
"Sorry," Rydell said, "but I'm staying here with Buell and 100 or so of his close personal friends."
He looked at the can in his hand, something called King Cobra. He took a sip.
"You want to go?
Go. Otherwise, just kill me."
"God damn you, Creedmoor,"
Randy Schoetz said, stepping heavily down from the stage. "You fucking drug addict! You're drunk! Drunk and ripped to the tits on Dancer!" Creedmoor goggled up at the big guitar player, his eyes all pupil.
"Jesus, Randy," he began. "You know, I just needed to get a little loose."
"Loose?
Loose?
Jesus, you forgot the words to drop that jerk and come with me. How fuck do you have to be to do that?" "Fucking audience knew the words, man. They were singing along with you. Trying to, anyway." Schoetz rammed his calloused thumb into Creedmoor's chest for emphasis. "I told you I don't work with diz monkeys. You're toast, understand? Out of here. History." Creedmoor seemed to reach far down into the depths of his being, as if to summon some new degree of honesty in order to face this moment of crisis. He seemed to find it, drew himself more upright.
"Fuck you," he said. "Motherfucker," he added,
as Schoetz, disgusted, turned and walked away.
"Buell,"
Rydell said, "they got a table or something reserved for you here, someplace I could sit down?"
"Mary Alice,"
Creedmoor said, thoughts elsewhere, waving in the general direction of the back of the bar. He set off, apparently after Schoetz. Rydell ignored the man with the tonto and headed for the back of the bar, where he found Mary Alice seated alone at a table. There was a hand-lettered sign on brown corrugated cardboard done in different colored felt pens that said, asterisk, 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 Buell Creedmoor, asterisk, 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 and his lower companions, each of the O's done in red as a little happy face. The table was solid side to side with empties, and Mary Alice looked like somebody had just whacked her in the head with something that didn't leave a mark.
"You ain't her?"
she asked Rydell, as if startled from a dream. "I'm Barry Rydell," he said, pulling out a chair and unslinging the bag with the projector. "Met earlier. You're Mary Alice."
"Yes,"
she smiled, as if pleased with the convenience of being so reminded.
"I am. Wasn't Buell wonderful?"
Rydell sat, trying to find a way to manage it that kept the rib from killing him. "They got an outlet around here, Mary Alice?" He was opening the duffel, pushing it down around the sides of the projector, pulling out the power cable.
"You're A&R,"
Mary Alice said, delighted, seeing the projector.
"I knew you were. Which label?"
"Plug this in there, please." Rydell pointed to an outlet just beside her, on the scabrous wall, and passed her the plug end of the cable. She held it close to her face, blinked at it, looked around, saw the socket, plugged it in, turned back to Rydell as if puzzled by what she'd just done. The man with the tonto brought over a chair, placed it at the table, and took a seat opposite Mary Alice. He did it somehow in a way that occupied as little of anyone else's consciousness as possible.
"Now you," Mary Alice said to him with a quick glance down to check the state of her bodice, "you are pretty clearly a label head, am I correct?"
"Label?"
"I knew you were," Mary Alice said.
Rydell heard the projector humming. And then Ray Toy was there, standing beside their table, and Rydell knew that once again he'd seen her naked for a second, glowing, white. But now she wore an outfit identical, it seemed, to Mary Alice's.
"Hello, Barry Rydell,"
she said, then looked down and tightened the strings at the top of the black thing she wore. "Hey," Rydell said.
"Well, suck me raw with a breast pump,"
Mary Alice said, voice soft with amazement, as she stared at Ray Toy.
"I swear to God I didn't see you standing there."
The man with the tonto was looking at Ray Toy, too, the light of her projection reflected in the round lenses.
"We are in a nightclub, Barry Rydell?"
"A bar," Rydell said.
"Rez liked bars,"
she said, looking around at the crowd.
"I have the impression that people in bars, though they seem to be talking to one another, are actually talking to themselves. Is this because higher brain function has been suppressed for recreational purposes?"
"I just love your top," Mary Alice said.
"I am Ray Toy."
"Mary Alice,"
Mary Alice said, extending her hand. The Idoro did likewise, her hand passing through Mary Alice's. Mary Alice shivered.
"Had about enough this evening,"
she said, as if to herself.
"I am Ray Toy,"
to the man with the tonto. "Good evening."
"I know your name," she gently said to the man. "I know a great deal about you. You are a fascinating person."
He looked at her, expression unchanged. "Thank you," he said. End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.